I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome to Fronteras, a show about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest. It's commonly said that history is written by the victors. When it comes to San Antonio, that isn't necessarily the case. It's a city most famously known for the Battle of the Alamo, which fell to Mexican troops. And yes, the Alamo is central to San Antonio's story, as is its Mexican-American culture. But there's another story that needs to be told about the Alamo City, the African-American story. Everett Fly is a San Antonio architect and landscape architect. He joins us on Fronteras to peel back the veil on the hidden history of San Antonio and how he came to uncover it.
I began to uncover San Antonio African American history after I finished my schooling, my graduate work and undergraduate work, and came back to San Antonio, and I was appointed to the City of San Antonio Historic and Review Board. The appointment that I had was the mayor's appointee. And so that meant, since the mayor serves at large, that meant that I had to represent the mayor at large. In other words, I was not restricted to a particular city council district or geographic location. Wherever the mayor needed some expertise or needed a report from something that affected a historic landmark or site or place, that's where I went. And of course, as I began to do that, these little bits and pieces and fragments of African American history began to, you know, cross my path. And so I kept a set of notes and began to do a little bit of research on my own and try to figure out who some of these people were and some of the places. And we have such a great set of repositories here. The Bexar County Spanish Archives, for example, is here. The city clerk's records go back to the early 1800s, cattle brands and deed records and marriage certificates. And so that's how I began to piece it together. And then when San Antonio was developing the concept for the Alamo Dome, we were required to do historic impact assessment, how it would affect the Near East Side along Cherry Street, and East Commerce and East Houston, you know, in that region. And of course, there was quite a bit of African-American history there. So that just added to my collection of information.
And so for people who aren't really familiar with San Antonio, it's divided into certain parts. And for the most part, people think of the west side of San Antonio as being predominantly Mexican-American and the east side as being predominantly African-American. And in a conversation we had earlier, you had mentioned that that necessarily was not the case for the east side of town.
That is correct, and it's verified again by the deed records and the land records. I began to find land sales to African-Americans west of the San Antonio River as early as 1866. And then, of course, if you go back a little bit further and you look at census records for people that owned African-American slaves, the places they lived were all over the county, not just east of the river. But after emancipation, there were a number of white landowners that had property all over what we call the town square or the town proper, east and west of the river. And so their names are on the deeds with the African Americans on the west side, on the south side, on the north side. And so that really piqued my interest. And so I began to plot dots, being an architect and a landscape architect, plot dots on a map to see where they occurred. And sure enough, they're on both sides of the river. It wasn't until we got to around 1900 that the practice of making bank loans for mortgages and that kind of thing came into being. And so that began to cause or produce a shift in the population.
Well, the Spanish were very good at keeping records. They recorded just about everything when they landed here. And that record keeping was pretty vital, I'm assuming, for you to be able to discover so many of these black landowners who were freed slaves. Can you tell us a little bit more about their stories?
Sure. For example, the gentleman Felipe Eloa, who came from Louisiana to Texas in 1807. We never would have found out about Mr. Eloa without the Spanish archives. And the petition that he filed for his land, the 1817 petition, I have a copy. it's written in Spanish. So I had to dust off my high school Spanish to interpret it and then get some more advanced Spanish speakers to fact check me. And so we found out that Mr. Eloa owned 7 acres, a little bit more than 7 acres of land east of what is now I-37. And it just happens to be in the area I mentioned where the Alamo Dome, and that's how I came across him. But he also, Mr. Eloa, also owned land on the edge of what we now know or recognize as Alamo Plaza. But all that information is, it's in the deed records. Mr. Eloa stayed in San Antonio, of course, until the Battle of the Alamo. And his property, of course, was so close to the battle that he had to get out of harm's way. So he and other landowners, his neighbors, evacuated. A group of them went to Nacogdoches, which is northeast of here in far northeast Texas. But that would have been the other major colonial settlement, Spanish colonial settlement. So they went to Nacogdoches to ride out the battle, as they say. But by the time Mr. Eloa got back, some of his land had been confiscated. And then he petitioned again to get it back, and wound up receiving more than 2,000 acres along the Guadalupe River in Guadalupe County.
Were there any issues with the black landowners as far as owning land? Because I know that those restrictions became a lot stricter as the decades went on. African Americans were not able to own land. Was that an issue?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, the Texas Constitution, the Republic of Texas Constitution, excluded African Americans from owning land. And a good case of that is Samuel McCulloch. Samuel was the son of a white father and a black mother. And he and his family came to Texas in 1835, right about the time of the fight for independence. Samuel served in the Republic of Texas Army, and he was wounded in 1835 at the Battle of Goliad. And after the war ended, he applied for his bounty, his pay, so to speak. The Republic was paying their veterans with land, but because Samuel was mulatto or mixed heritage or African American, his receipt of his land, it took him 13 years to get it, and he filed multiple appeals. The recorded appeals are in the Texas State Archives. That's how we know that he went through this process. And finally, 13 years later, 1850, he received more than 2,000 acres of land in southwest Bexar County. When you look at the state archives, it includes a signed letter from General Sam Houston. So we think that that helped him finally get his land.
Mr. McCulloch, apparently, if I read this correctly, he was the first to shed blood in the Texas Revolution?
That's correct. All of the major historians agree on that point, that he was the first person wounded in the Texas Revolution.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the cattle brands. I think this is pretty fascinating that many of the black landowners had their own cattle brands. And are those cattle brands around today?
That's a great, great question. When we've been able to conduct oral interviews and find records, we discover that there were African Americans involved in the cattle industry during slavery. And once they were emancipated, of course, they continued the tradition, but owning cattle was a sign of independence. Even if you had one cow, that cow could be bred to give you a calf or two over time. That would give you food, meat to eat, so to speak, or you could barter and trade in cattle, you know, according to the customs of Texas ranching and so forth. And so we first discovered a family north of in North Bexar County, the Winters and the Griffins and the Jacksons, who began to accumulate land as early as 1866. But we also began to find their cattle brands registered in the Bexar County Spanish Archives in the clerk's office. Texas law says that once you file your brand, it's yours for 10 years, and then you have to renew it. And so what we found is that most of these brands, there are more than 40 that we've come across now, most of them were never renewed. A few of them were passed on from, say, a father to a son or a father to a nephew or a brother, but they didn't renew them after the first 10 or 20 years. So we've been collecting the brands, and we've re-registered them under the San Antonio African American Community Archive and Museum. And the idea is that we would keep these brands registered so that folks would be able to see them, but we could also manage the authenticity of them because the brands have the name of the person. In some cases, it has the location where they kept their cattle, like on the Medina River or on the Almas Creek or on the Cibolo Creek. And then in a few instances, after the name of the person, it actually says colored. So that gives us another source to authenticate where they lived and their involvement in the cattle industry.
That's San Antonio architect and landscape architect Everett Fly. When Fronteras returns, Fly will tell us about discovering the oldest black settlement in the U.S. and its ties to literature.
So I made the connection that not only did that have significance in the Native American culture, but it also had significance in African-American literary culture through Zora Neale Hurston's book.
Stay with us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to Fronteras. Everett Fly is an award-winning San Antonio architect and landscape architect. In case you've just joined us, Fly has been telling us about discovering the recent African-American history of San Antonio before the Texas Revolution and after the Civil War. Black landowners and cattle ranchers were not uncommon. Fly also plays a crucial role in seeking out historic black settlements in the U.S., including one that so far is the oldest black settlement discovered in the country, in Florida.
I began to study black settlements during my graduate work. It was a history course. It was called the History of the Built American Landscape. I actually found old newspaper articles that mentioned a black town in Florida called Eatonville. And Eatonville today, if you were to go there, it's on the north edge of Orlando. If anyone's ever been to Orlando to go to Disney World or to the resorts, that's where Eatonville is located. But I had found these newspaper articles that mentioned it. In most cases, there were only a few lines, and it would say there's a colored colony in Florida that is named Eatonville, and they have their own school. And so I began to research it. But one of my graduate school classmates, by coincidence, was a native of that area, of that Orlando, Central Florida area. And after we graduated, he went back home. Orange County proposed to build a road, a four-lane throughway, but they were going to run it through the middle of this little town, 2,000 population, run it through the middle of town simply for the purposes of traffic connection to connect the east side of the county to the west side. But the residents of Eatonville were looking for a strategy to protect the community. My classmate went to a meeting and they were discussing it, and he said, you know, I had a classmate named Everett who has been researching historic black towns. Maybe he could help you. So one day, now almost 30 years ago, my phone rang here in San Antonio, and there was a lady on the other end. Her name is N.Y. Nathiri, and she's a native of Eatonville, and she asked if I had any expertise regarding historic preservation that they could use to build a case against putting this road through the middle of their town. We were able to work out an arrangement, went to Eatonville, and just as I've done here, I began to look for old maps and old records. And sure enough, I found in the Orange County Clerk's office, I found an 1856 map that showed the road through Eatonville. And in 1856, Eatonville wasn't actually there, but the road was a trail that the indigenous and Native Americans used in their hunting expeditions in different seasons. Interestingly enough, the road became the namesake in Zora Neale Hurston's book, Dust Tracks on the Road. So I made the connection that not only did that have significance in the Native American culture, but it also had significance in African American literary culture through Zora Neale Hurston's book. And Zora lived in Eatonville during her childhood. That became the setting for a number of her folklore books and her folk writing. So that was the significance. And we began to build a case along that line, we conducted an inventory of the structures in Eatonville, and Eatonville joined with some neighboring communities, and they were able, believe it or not, they were able to defeat the road proposal, and it stopped the county from essentially cutting the community in half.
So how far back does the community of Eatonville date back?
Eatonville, I believe it's 1887, is when the community was officially incorporated. Of course, like many other parts of the South, African Americans were there as slaves before that, before 1865. But after emancipation, they stayed in the area, and they had actually become very proficient in the agricultural industry, more specifically citrus growing, orange trees, lime trees, lemon trees, those kinds of citrus growing. By owning the land, they were able to buy land from white landowners. By owning their own land, they were able to have their own citrus groves.
Circling back around to San Antonio, there is an effort that you are getting underway, which is founding a museum, but it's not going to be a brick-and-mortar museum. Can you tell us some more about that?
Well, we come up with the concept of trying to protect as many historic resources records as possible, but also recognizing that oral history is very important in the African-American culture and tradition. And so folks that have oral history are, as we all are, they're getting older each day. And the way you collect that oral history, of course, is to do an audio and or video recording. So we came up with the idea that if we could scan records, scan a photograph, or scan pages out of the family Bible that has the names, the births and the deaths and the christenings and so forth, and then record survivors, heirs of those families, we could do that more quickly than trying to get hard copies of all the documents. So we've been able to work out a collaboration with the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. They have what they call the Southern Historical Collection, and they're interested in the entire South, not just North Carolina. And UNC has been able to get a grant from the Andrew Mellon Foundation that includes us here in San Antonio, the San Antonio African American Community Archive and Museum, as a working partner. Our effort to make this model work will serve as an example for other communities across the country. We're not saying we know everything. We're not saying our model is going to be perfect, but San Antonio and our region has a remarkable set of archives and data sources and so forth. And so that's what we're trying to build on. So our goal is to map out kind of the steps, the techniques, the kinds of participants you need to have to make something like this work. And certainly it'll reinforce what we're doing here.
And can it already be accessed online?
Not yet. We're starting the entry point, the ground zero for it, at the intersection of Cherry and Dawson, 430 North Cherry. And the reason we're starting there is that that house that's on the corner is the house that Mr. Samuel Sutton raised his family in. Mr. Samuel Sutton was one of the first African-American school teachers in San Antonio in the 1890s. You would also recognize the Sutton name. Representative G.J. Sutton was the first African-American elected to public office in a general election in Texas. And so Mr. Sutton, G.J. is a member of that family. G.J. and Percy were brothers. The Percy Sutton family is the ones that live in New York, and they own the Apollo Theater. They were judges, they were teachers, they were scientists. They were just a remarkable family. So we're using that building to start as our ground zero. And so we'll have digital exhibits there. We'll have kind of the static exhibit panels there where people can see. And then the idea is to link digitally, access digitally with local universities, local museums and institutions. And ultimately, Norma, we'd like to have just average citizens to be able to get on their computers or get on their pads, electronic pads, or even on their phones and access some of the information.
And so are you accepting submissions of stories, videos from the public in case maybe somebody listening might have a story to share?
Oh, absolutely. If you are interested in sharing a story, you can email San Antonio African American Community Archive and Museum, SACAM. The address is admin, A-D-M-I-N, at SAAACAM.org. We have volunteers and board members that are monitoring the email, and we can set up and schedule an appointment to meet with you. We can even come where you are and look at what you have and make an assessment and work from there.
We've been talking with Everett Fly, a San Antonio architect and landscape architect. He's a 2014 National Humanities Medalist, honored by the White House for preserving the integrity of African-American places and landmarks. Fly estimates there are over 1,200 forgotten and unrecognized African-American and Native American settlements in the U.S. And that's it for Fronteras and our stories from the Southwest this week. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org. Fronteras is also available for download as a podcast. Norma Martinez and Jerry Quijano produced the broadcast. Our executive producers are Steve Short and Fernando Ortiz. Our digital editor is Vince Kong. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. Thanks for joining us. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.